somebody asked me about you, mm-hmm. and it was like somebody that has zero aviation, like,
just
like
a
connotation in my life. Yeah. Yeah. It was like a friend of my wife's was like, oh, do you know Airplane Facts with Max? I'm like, what's that? Is that like a game?
Yeah. And same with me. It was my wife, though. My wife is absolutely in love with you because she is a Lord of the Rings absolute psycho nut. She is obsessed with that. Reads the whole trilogy. Like.
By the way, you called your wife a psycho nut a minute ago on the podcast. Do we edit that? Or?
You might need to edit that out.
A Lord of the Rings psycho. Well, now I'll have all the Lord of the Rings people coming after me, right?
Yeah, you might. It's a dangerous group.
Hello, I'm Steve Giordano.
And I'm Bob Allen.
And this is Cockpit Casual, the podcast.
Yeah.
Week 5.
We're already on 5. Wow. We've been doing good.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying headphones on for the first time. It's kind of awkward.
Yeah, well, you're like a real podcaster now.
I don't feel like one, but anyway, glad we can get this done. I mean, we got a really cool episode here coming up, as you will see soon. But I've been busy all day with Kitty Hawk. Kitty Hawk, my app that some of you all know about, got some really cool things going on with that. And an AI layer we're building out that's going to have some really cool functions that's really going to help people network and companies really market what they're doing. So the more people I can get over to Kitty Hawk, companies, people, the more it's going to help everybody. So, hey, come on over to Kitty Hawk, check out the app.
Right on. What an AI layer. Everything's AI nowadays. I mean, including like everything I do, it seems like, well, not everything. I still write Cockpit Casual without AI. It does help me with the sound editing quite a bit and stuff. But man, I'm always asking AI. So does it have a name like Grok or something?
Orville.
Nice.
As an Orville Wright, you know, Kitty Hawk, the whole, you know. So, yeah, a lot of people are using AI, you know, kind of like a search engine.
Yeah.
And that's, it does. Yeah. I mean, that's like 0.1% of what the, you know, AI can, you know, help you do. So is what we're putting it in there is basically an AI assistant for users. I mean, the AI will be working in the background to help connect you to people that are going to help you with your career or help you find the right airplane that you're looking for, help you find maintenance, help you find parts. Whatever you need aviation wise, it's actually there working in the background to get what you need.
It feels like it's the future of most software. There's going to be like an AI assistant that knows the software, and that can't happen too soon, in my opinion, man, because, you know, that's kind of the biggest limitation with like consumer grade AI that I've noticed is that, you know, I mean, it's great. It figures stuff out. You can upload some basic files. I mean, even like spreadsheets and whatnot, but it doesn't really operate the software right yet.
Yeah.
I figure like that has to be like proprietarily built, if that's a word.
There's some function issues with, you know, proprietary software and what you're allowing another software to use and things like that, but it's becoming a lot more open with API and just the technology is running so fast. I mean, it's happening so fast, the AI thing. I've got some big names in AI that are interested in what I'm doing with aviation, to the point where I'm going to have to go out and raise some funds. I've got to go out and get some like institutional level money. And
I need some institutional level money too.
Don't we all? Don't we all?
Well, I, not to interrupt you, we got to kind of keep things rolling this morning. As a matter of fact, this episode is going to be quite different in that we're not going to, you know, much to your dismay, fans, we're not going to BS with just each other a whole lot, because we had an awesome interview this week. We had Max Comer, which you probably know as Airplane Facts with Max. And what was going to be like a quick chat turned into just an hour long, actually an hour and 20,
20 hour, 30
and 20. Yeah. It was just a great conversation. It was awesome. We talked about stuff that I didn't even know we were going to get into. So,
you're going to love
it. You know,
it.
In a few minutes, you'll hear it. You'll have Max Comer and Bob and I going round and round.
And if you don't know who he is, you've got to go check out his stuff on Instagram and TikTok. Those are the two places that I follow him.
He has like 1.5 million on Instagram and 500,000 on TikTok. And I mean, the funny thing is he's not like a influencer type guy, like,
not at all
mentality. In fact, he's so humble. He can't even, you know, he like gets embarrassed when you talk about how big his following is, but he's a great musician and there's just, the guy brings so much to the table.
All around awesome. Great guy.
Great guy. Yeah. Great guy. But there has been some stuff I do want to get to before. A lot of people on socials have been asking our opinions. I don't want to have an accident analysis podcast.
Right.
You know, that's not who we are. We're not qualified to do that. But I do think that we can discuss some things. And, you know, there was a really tragic accident at LaGuardia this week involving a Air Canada Jazz CRJ and some ground equipment, a ground truck, where the pilots lost their lives. I mean, fortunately, they're the only ones that lost their lives, but unfortunately
amazingly
for them. Yeah. Yeah.
You look at that and you go, wow, how did more people not get killed in that accident?
Just terrible. And you know, in typical social media 2026 fashion, everyone's quick to point fingers. I mean, there is blame to go around on this one for sure. Bob, you're frozen. Man, we had one mission. Our one mission was to record a 10-minute intro to the Airplane Facts with Max, the Max Comer interview episode, and we couldn't get through it. We tried for the past hour and a half, and Bob's having internet stability issues at his house in Arizona, so he's going to upgrade to fiber, but that doesn't help us. We just couldn't make it happen today, so I'm going to finish up the rest of the intro myself here without Bob, and then we'll go right into the interview. So I just wanted to say, and Bob and I have both kind of discussed this at length, the accident in LaGuardia. I wanted to put our comments on the record on the pod this week because that's what everybody's talking about. And you know, obviously it's a terrible situation, and there's so much blame that goes around. Everyone wants to point a finger. You know, it is very important that all accidents are investigated, thoroughly investigated, and the findings are used to make aviation safer. That is why we have such a safe aviation system in the United States and essentially worldwide. But this one's pretty straightforward, really. Obviously, you know, the air traffic controller gave a clearance while stressed to the max dealing with another emergency. One controller operating in the wee hours, which is pretty normal. Obviously, there's some fault there, lies with the air traffic controller having given that clearance. But at the same time, when you're talking about runway incursions, the responsibility lies with the person that is crossing the runway, whether that be in an aircraft or in a vehicle. And the crew of the CRJ did everything right. You know, it was a valiant and heroic attempt to stop the aircraft on the runway, and it cost them their lives, sadly. No fault there whatsoever. But obviously, the problem, I would say 90 to 95% of the blame on this thing is got to go to the truck. You know, you don't cross a runway without looking, clearance or not. You know, I can't even stress how many times I've been unsure of a clearance where I've just stopped. And if it pisses off the controller, you know, because I wasn't listening the first time, you're better safe than sorry. And the bottom line is, in this case, yes, the fire truck received a clearance to cross the runway and shouldn't have, but that clearance was taken back when the controller realized what was going on. But you don't cross a runway without visually verifying. And where that aircraft was on short final was absolutely visible. It looks like it was a matter of whoever was driving that truck not looking before crossing the runway, and that just, that's it. And you know, by examining the video, you can see that the runway holds short markings. The lighted yellow amber lines were illuminated. I mean, there's just no circumstance where you can ever cross, you know, an illuminated hold short line with or without clearance, and certainly without looking both ways, both directions. Clear left, clear right. You'll hear us say it on every cockpit casual video. Every pilot in every cockpit from, I mean, even single pilot, even students that are learning on a Cherokee 140 or a Cessna 152 get in the habit from day one of saying clear right, clear left, you know, looking, verifying. It's just, you must verify. And sadly, this cost two people, innocent people, their lives because somebody didn't verify. So, you know, to my brothers and sisters that are flying and operating aircraft, let's just all internalize this reality and just remember every time, look visually, verify, have the person sitting next to you also visually verify. And if you're in doubt, stop, question, ask. And these things are entirely preventable. So anyway, that's what I have to say about the event in LaGuardia. Bob will have his internet situation fixed by next week. And now, enjoy the interview with Max Comer and his music to close it out, just like we did with Pat the other day. See you next week. All right, I'm excited about this one. We have Max Comer on the pod today, and people know him as Airplane Facts with Max. I mean, lots of people know him as that. Millions of people know him as that.
Allegedly. A lot more people know him than us.
For sure. By a lot, like by an exponential number.
Maybe.
He is a well-known social media guy. I'm super stoked. Funny thing, actually, I first found out about your account. Somebody asked me about you. Mm-hmm. And it was like somebody that has zero aviation, like,
just a
connotation
normal,
in my life. Yeah. Yeah. It was like a friend of my wife's was like, oh, do you know Airplane Facts with Max? I'm like, what's that? Is that like a game?
Yeah. And same with me. It was my wife, though. My wife is absolutely in love with you because she is a Lord of the Rings absolute psycho nut. She is obsessed with that. Reads the whole trilogy like yearly, and she kept sending me your clips, your Instagram. She was forwarding these things to me over and over. You check this guy out, check this guy out. I'm like, he's reading The Hobbit or something. I'm like, what, you know? Then I started, you know, watching it, and I started getting into it as well.
Yeah.
By the way, you called your wife a psycho nut a minute ago on the podcast. Do we edit that? Or?
You might need to edit that out.
A Lord of the Rings psycho. Well, now I'll have all the Lord of the Rings people coming after me, right?
Yeah, you might. Yeah. It's a dangerous group.
I know.
I got it. So, I got it right here.
Oh, man. And I see that it's bookmarked, so there may be some citations read, I'm guessing.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't prepare for this. It's bookmarked with a Starrett drill chart, actually. So,
well, my guess is that when the relevant topic comes up, you will have one ready to go and probably even know the page number.
We'll see.
Well, so Max is an airframe and power plant mechanic, an AMP mechanic. He works for a major airline at their heavy maintenance facility now in the U.S. And, you know, he's come to prominence on social media delivering little known facts about aircraft from a mechanic's perspective, which I think is awesome because it's such a misunderstood profession, and, you know, to the outside world, and things seem scarier than they really are in a lot of cases. And I think your big appeal over the years has been talking about like legit things in layman's terms that everybody can understand, and in an interesting manner while interjecting, you know, Hobbit references.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that when I first started the page, I didn't really expect it to get any views at all. And then over time, I started to realize that a lot of people don't know anything about aircraft maintenance. They don't even, they don't think about it unless their
flight's
delayed.
Pilots included.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, things that I do every day at work that I'm looking at, I'm like, oh, this is just another wheel well. How boring. But then you show that on the internet, people are like, this is crazy. And you're like, yeah, is it? I guess it is. And, you know, when you don't look at it every day, you realize that there's a lot of stuff you can talk about.
Yeah,
absolutely. Share. That's how Bob started, I think, with the same thing.
Same thing. I just started walking around the airplane and people could like kind of care less about the outside of the airplane. I would walk into the 737 wheel well and they kept asking me, what is that? And I started explaining it, and following started kind of blowing up from there.
Yeah. People also really like seeing the inside of an empty aircraft when there's no seats in it and stuff like that. They're like, that's what it looks like. You're like, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
The dance floor, the soccer field.
Yeah, a lot of room for activities.
All right.
So where did you grow up? Like location, like where are you from?
I'm from Colorado originally. Yeah.
Okay. I grew Denver up there, or
Littleton. Yeah. Just a suburb of Denver.
Okay. And what did young Max want to be when he grew up?
A history teacher, actually.
What? Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that would be cool. I don't know. And then I didn't want to go to college. So I went to college for a little bit. I wanted to be a rock star, obviously. Everybody wants to do that.
Yes.
That's why we're all here.
Work out. Now I fix airplanes.
Yeah.
I mean, it still might.
maybe.
It's funny. It's just yet another guest with another musical tie-in. Music is a big part of my life and Bob's as well. I mean, my father's a jazz musician. My great uncle who's passed, my grandmother's brother was a clarinetist in the Winston-Salem Philharmonic. I mean, we have a lot of music in our family. Bob plays. We're all want to be rock stars.
I see the amp behind you. That's a cool amp.
Yeah, I'm a big gearhead. I think music is so that I can buy more equipment to listen through it through.
Yeah.
Versus playing music.
Yeah, I agree, actually. Yeah. I got a couple amps over here and I just like to look at them. I never plug them in.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to collect them. I like to kind of tinker with them. Get electrocuted every once in a while.
So you somehow managed to become an A&P mechanic. Like what was like the driver on that? Like how do you like go from wanting to be a history teacher to picking up a wrench?
I needed health care. I needed health insurance. That's kind of half true, half not. So after I dropped out of college my first year, just because I didn't like it, I was bartending and I was having fun bartending. And then I had a son. And when my son was about a year old, I was like, I gotta figure something out. I gotta do something. And my friend was going to school to be an A&P mechanic to get his A&P license. And his dad was a mechanic. And he's like, dude, you should come fix airplanes with me. And I was like, that sounds cool. I never really thought about fixing airplanes, but that sounds like a cool job. I could see myself doing that. I always liked to work on stuff with my dad. So I never was like a professional mechanic before, but you know, I knew how to use tools.
Mechanic school skills.
Yeah. And I just thought it sounded like a cool job. I was like, I could tell people I fix airplanes and I think airplanes are cool. I've always liked airplanes. I wasn't like an aviation kid necessarily, but I kind of was compared to like normal people. I liked World War II planes a lot. It was really big.
Yeah.
Like the history side of aviation, the historical side. And so it just sounded like something that sounded interesting.
Yeah. So did you immediately start working as a mechanic while you were in school, or were you like an apprentice?
No, it's really hard to find places that will, at least back then, it was hard to find places that would hire you, especially in the Denver area, if you weren't licensed. If you didn't have your license, you're like, get out of here. So while I was in school, I still bartended after school, and I worked at the airport doing ramping, and a little bit of de-icing. And then just to kind of be around the airplanes, I thought it might help to like be around them and kind of learn something about them, you know, at least when I get in the field, I'll know how to open a cargo door.
Right.
And then after school, you know, the regionals were always hiring mechanics back then. So I had a job offer from Horizon Air before I even finished getting my rating.
Was it in Denver or was it Horizon up in Seattle or?
I worked in Spokane. I went up to Spokane, mm-hmm. Washington, and worked for Horizon up there and then cut my teeth on the Q400, which
is I'm a Dash 8 guy. So I
yeah, see, respect. I love the Q400. It is a nightmare to work on.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, which I didn't know at the time because it was the first time I ever worked on an airplane. So I was like, this is just how airplanes are, I guess. And then I started working on Boeings and stuff and Airbus. And I was like, oh, that the Dash 8 sucks to work on.
Yeah. It's everything's smaller. Everything's tight and like tucked in.
Yeah. The places they put stuff, I'm like, why was that a good idea? Why are we doing that? and why do they use DC ground power? Anyways, sorry.
Yeah. So, yeah, ironically, I actually, you know, I cut my teeth in the Dash in Denver as well. So I was a Denver-based captain for Mesa Airlines, flying United Express from, you know, Denver to Colorado Springs, Aspen Eagle, Gunnison, you know,
nice.
Jackson nice. Hole, Rapid City, all that fun stuff. So did all the ski airports. It was a great time. Denver's a great town. So
yeah, I love Denver. I miss it, but this is home now.
Right on.
So how long were you at Horizon?
A little bit over a year. Not that long. Yeah. Just long enough.
Yeah. At Horizon, you were an LMT, a line maintenance technician, I'm assuming, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I worked on I was overnight line maintenance there.
Pilots. The only interface that most airline pilots have with maintenance is through a line maintenance technician. So when you say A&P, most pilots don't even really think about anything other than the guy that shows up when you call maintenance control. And so let me kind of explain that dynamic from an airline perspective to people that may be listening that have never worked for an airline or aren't in the industry. So when you have a problem with an aircraft, whether it's returning to the gate, you know, or coming to the gate at the end of a trip, or you start, you push, you come back to the gate because of a maintenance problem, or you get onto the airplane, you notice something on the pre-flight isn't right, the first call you make isn't to a mechanic, it's to somebody who's called a maintenance controller. And every airline has a maintenance controller or a room full of maintenance controllers that are essentially dispatchers, but for the maintenance side of things. So like am I right on that? I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
So most of the time a maintenance controller is someone who has an A&P or has been a line mechanic at some point. They usually know something about, you know, airplanes and maintenance, but like at this point they ride the desk and they call up a tech and they dispatch a tech over, you know, generally a van pulls up, you know, with two guys in it and a bunch of tooling in the back and maybe some parts if they already know what to expect. So as a line mechanic, I assume, like at Horizon, I mean, it's a small station in Spokane.
Yeah.
I guess there's maintenance control is at the airline's main base. So it's Seattle, probably in Seattle for
Portland. For Horizon is Portland, yeah.
Okay. So pilot calls, maintenance control. I got a gear unsafe light here at the gate. And I can't tell why. All right, we'll have someone out in a minute. What are you doing generally when there's nothing going on as a line mechanic?
Like before you have a call?
Yeah.
You're just kind of chilling.
So it's like a break room now, type of a thing?
Yeah, it's a maintenance office. We drink coffee and you're doing your CBTs and training stuff. And you know,
tell stories, listen to podcasts, watch Cockpit Casual.
Yeah,
basically. Browse Instagram.
Now, that's if you're working on the day shift, which I was never allowed to work the day shift because I never had enough time to do that. And so what would happen for in my experience as a line maintenance technician is we would have the planes come in on their last leg of the night and we would do most of the work, the regular scheduled work overnight. So you work from, you know, 10 p.m. until 8 a.m. or whatever it is. And so the planes would come in with a bill of work and you're like, okay, we got to do a check on the FADEC or something. You know what I mean? Whatever. Yeah. You might be changing prop blades or whatever. And then you'll find other things that need to be changed that night too. So you'll have a task card that has you inspect all these things, service the hydraulics, change tires, change brakes. You know, that way in the morning, the plane's good to go. Pilots get in. Hopefully there's no problems.
So that's the equivalent of like a daily check, basically. Like
And we would go out every night. We'd have, you know, we'd be responsible for one or two aircraft for a couple guys. And we'd just go through the airplanes and do whatever they needed us to do on it. And then at the end of the night, if there's more work that can be done through MELs or NEF items, we'll kind of take care of those. You know, like if there's a piece of trim that needs replaced and we have the trim and we have the time, we'll replace it. But if not, you know, we focus on the more important issues first.
Yeah.
Right. Like yeah. MELs, for those that aren't familiar, it's a minimum equipment list is what it stands for. But it's a defect on the aircraft where the aircraft can keep operating for a limited period of time. And so there are different categories of deferrable items where some things have to be fixed within, like, you know, I don't know, 5 days. One of them's like, you know, a month. You know, so depending on the importance of the component. And in my experience, now I worked for a low cost carrier. In my experience, you know, the MELs indefinite. Would pile up until the last possible day.
Yeah.
And then everybody.
Yeah. And then a bunch of stickers in the logbook.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
And then signed off as ops checks good.
Yeah, pretty much.
So line maintenance techs, I never even thought about that. At night is when you're busy, when you're dealing with all the stuff that has to happen every night. Everything during the day is essentially non-routine.
Everything during the day is going to be, you know, servicing engine oil between flight legs or whatever needs to happen. Maybe tires, maybe brakes. But typically, if it's something that can be deferred, they defer it. And then at night, we'll fix it. So on the line, for instance, during the day, there might be two mechanics and a lead mechanic on where I was at my base. Mm-hmm. And then at night, there would be 20 of us, you know?
Okay. By the way, this is not on my list of things to ask, but I've always noticed that there's always only like one guy who knows avionics.
Like, yeah, it's not me.
True.
It's not me.
Right? That's most techs. Like most techs, you come out and you're like, I got a problem with this. Yeah. Let me call Bill.
Yeah, I got to call Bill. Bill knows this one. Yeah.
Yeah. He knows what circuit breaker to pull.
Yeah.
Just some people just have an aptitude for avionics. Is that how that works?
Yeah. On the line side, I would say so, at least where I was. Now, where I work, we have a full avionics department, and I could bid into it if I wanted to, but I don't want to. And that's all they do is all the avionics stuff. And then I am what they call a general mechanic. So I do all the greasy stuff.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, getting back into that line maintenance role, did you get to know certain pilots that were kind of notorious for writing up certain things?
I usually didn't really see the pilots. Typically, when I saw the pilots, they'd come in on their last leg and they just wanted to get to the hotel or they wanted to go home. They didn't want to hang out and chit chat. No, but I did get to know certain aircraft that I was like, that one always has a problem.
Every airline I've ever worked for has that airplane.
Yeah, right? You're like, come on, man.
It's always different stuff too. It's sometimes it's repeating things, but it's the one culprit aircraft that has a nickname that is almost always the problem child.
Yeah.
Typically on the line, what we would do too is, you know, we'd work through the night until about 3 o'clock in the morning. We usually just would work through lunch just because we wanted to get all the work done. And then you get an hour or two of downtime. And then around 5 o'clock, we would go out and we'd kind of start up the airplanes for the pilots. Like we'd align the IRUs, make sure everything's turning on the way it's supposed to. That way, hopefully they don't need to call us out and then we're good. And we don't want them returning to the gate. You know what I mean? Especially for that first leg of the day is a pretty important day. Cause once if the first flights get kind of delayed, it just stacks up for the entire day.
I gotta say, like, so I alluded to this just before, and I know that we've said this a lot. So Bob and I, as ferry pilots, we are more kind of part of the maintenance side of things, for the most part. All of our, you know, our clients are lessors, airlines, but they're always the technical managers. They're always the suits that are in charge of the maintenance side of things. And, you know, we're dealing with continuing airworthiness and SFPs and limitations on SFPs and things like that. So, and we also do a lot of operational check test flights, right?
Those are cool.
Service. We do those constantly.
I've been up on one of those before. It was a lot of fun.
On what aircraft?
It was a 737.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fun.
We do that one all the time.
Yeah.
And the manual reversion check is always fun.
Yeah. It was something I've never experienced. I've never flown in a plane like that before. I was like, this isn't how you fly it with passengers at all.
Definitely not.
Do they let you feel how heavy the yoke is with I don't know how anybody would land an airplane.
I don't either. Especially
no, I didn't even go in the cockpit. I got to look in, but I didn't get to go in there. It was full of the people that were smarter than I am.
Well, I don't know about all that.
Yeah, well.
That's actually where I was going with this. And it's like, the reality is, and I know this because most of my friends, you know, hold an AMP, right? Mm-hmm. Whether they're technical managers or, you know, even pilots with an AMP or maintenance technicians. I mean, we're around these guys all the time. So a lot of the guy on-site reps, like most of my friends outside of work are on-site reps or somehow involved in like the on the technical side of things. And I listen to just hours and hours of complaining about pilots, you know, and I don't know too many pilots that complain about maintenance guys, but I absolutely understand why mechanics complain about pilots. And look, we're not going to name names here. You know, we're going to keep it friendly, but I would say that I guarantee you there are pilots listening that have no idea how frustrated mechanics may be with them individually. Let's let them be introspective after hearing this a little bit.
Yeah.
There are like, and here's the thing. First of all, I think that for the most part, you know, being a pilot means having an ego a lot of times. It is what it is.
Yeah.
It's the type of job that attracts control freaks, you know, self-important egomaniacs.
Guys who want to be right all the time.
Yeah. Guys who, yes, insist they're right all the time, who want to be visibly in charge. There's a lot of that in the airline pilot world. It's a pet peeve of ours. Trust me, there's nobody on earth that bitches about pilots as much as Bob. You take the most bitchy mechanic.
We're managing them all the time.
Yeah. If anyone flies more than two flights for Nomadic, you know they're cool because they're generally fired after one. I mean, that's just the rule, not the exception. I would say that if you know a pilot by name as a mechanic, that's not a good thing, right?
It's either not a good thing or it's a really good thing. It could go either way.
Right.
You know, you'd be like, he's really cool. Or it's like,
he's really cool. He's in a band. He's a good drummer. You know, I pick him up for shows.
Yeah. One of my best friends is a pilot. He's awesome.
Okay. But generally speaking,
I feel like it's like an ancient blood feud. You know what I mean? It's two houses that just will never, we're just, you know, even if I love them, I'm like, but you're still my enemy.
I'm hearing a Lord of the Rings quote coming here.
Yeah, you know, it's like the dwarves and the elves. You know what I mean? The dwarves are all like the dwarves and the elves. Their hatred goes back all the way to the Silmarillion when the dwarves took the Nauglamir from the King Thingol, right? You know,
I was thinking the same thing.
And it goes back to that. It's like the Wright brothers and Charles Taylor, you know?
Yeah.
The same thing. I'm just kidding. I think they were friends.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, though. I mean, reality, I have so much respect for AMPs. I think it's a much more difficult job in a lot of ways. Well, I mean, in every way, really, with the exception of the cost and time it takes to get to cost specifically to get to the point where you're a professional in that. Other than that, you have to know a lot more as a mechanic, and you have to know a lot more specific stuff. Having talked to a lot of these guys and gals, their level of systems knowledge is deep. And even stuff, and you have to realize they teach us, you know, we get a systems education in ground school, right? For each type. But it's like very, very surface level.
Very,
like very surface level.
Yeah, that's fair. I would say, though, that I think because of the differences between what we do between pilots and mechanics, it's just a different type of knowledge. You know, I think we as mechanics know the aircraft in a really different way than pilots do. And I've had people ask me all the time whenever I post a picture from inside the cockpit or something, like, could you land a plane if you needed? I was like, probably not, dude. I don't know how they do it. Maybe. Get me in a simulator. I'll find out.
Yeah. If you were an avionics guy, you could figure it out because you could.
Yeah, but I'm not. Boom. You know, I'm just a greasy guy.
Well, that's the reality of modern airplanes is that everything runs through the MCDU, man. Everything runs through the box. So if you know how to operate the box, you know, if you know how to play flight simulator, you could probably land an airplane. And I would go as far as saying, and I can tell you firsthand, like my son, who's a pilot now, he's just about to get his commercial, has always played a lot of flight simulator. We got a nice setup down in the basement. And I brought him on an A320 ferry. He already knew how to operate the MCDU completely.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. The other thing I would say about pilots and flight crew and general flight attendants and all that is just, I can't imagine having a job where I was on the road like you guys are all the time. That's a hard part just mentally that I think that would be kind of difficult for me. You know, I like coming home every day. And so I can't imagine being out on the road like that.
So especially the way we do it.
Right. So that leads me into a question. It's like, was it lifestyle that brought you from being a line maintenance guy to the heavy maintenance world?
Well, actually when I left Horizon, I mostly left because of just cost of living and how much they were not paying me. The wages have gone up quite a bit since then. And so I actually went and worked on trains for a little bit. I had a little the light rail in Denver. I worked on those for a little bit. And then I didn't love it. I missed being around the aircraft. I'm much more passionate about aviation than I am trains, even though I do love trains, for the record.
Yeah, me too. And so I've always loved trains.
Yeah. And so I came out here, to Oklahoma just cause the cost of living was lower and, they were paying similar to what I was making working on the trains, but I knew the top end was going to be a lot higher. And so that's what brought me into heavy maintenance. And then I kind of really enjoy doing the heavy maintenance side of things more than the line maintenance side, both because of lifestyle and just what we do. I do miss the line for a lot of reasons, but I don't miss working overnight. At least I get to work during the day now, which is nice.
Yeah.
And I like seeing the planes get completely taken apart. I like getting really into there and changing that changing landing gear is what I do that a lot. And it's one of my favorite jobs of my career. I love changing landing gear. I don't know. I just think it's fun.
Well, that's what, you know, I've always been curious, you know, because we're in these, you know, heavy maintenance shops. Probably 90% of the time that we're picking up an airplane, we're into a heavy maintenance MRO. Mm-hmm. And I see people working in different areas of the airplane. I'm always wondering, do mechanics specialize in certain areas of that heavy check?
Kind of. Yeah, kind of. The way we do it where I'm at, and I can't speak for how other MROs might do it, is people, I think, tend to kind of figure out when you first get into the heavy maintenance side, you kind of figure out what you might like and what you kind of are interested in. You know, there's people that really like doing structural repairs. There's people that really love working on the engines. They know everything about the engines. There's people that like working wings, you know, because there's so many systems that all need all this work done on them, especially in a heavy check. And so there's people that, we are considered generals, so they can put us anywhere they need us and we can figure it out. But typically there, you know, there's guys that you're like, oh, I got a question about how to rig these spoilers. And it's like, oh, he knows, you know, Mike knows how to do that.
There's some jobs, I would say that are probably more of an art form than necessarily technical expertise. And then there are certain things that are more technical than an art form, I guess.
Yeah,
like you got to know things about things. I mean, I'd almost compare it to, and I'm not in the medical field, but I do watch The Pit. You know, I would say, like, you know, you're a line tech or whatever. You're like an ER doc, right? You're triaging aircraft. Yeah. And you're going through like a wide base of general knowledge. And then where you are, you're a surgeon and you specialize in different areas. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And like, you know, I would say that suturing somebody is probably like kind of an art form. It's something that you got to have a steady hand and an eye. Like sheet metal seems to me like it would be that way.
Sheet metal is. Yeah. The sheet metal guys that are really good at it, they are, I think they're artists. You know, I watch them work and I'm just like, this is awesome. And I've done some doublers. I've done triblers. I've spliced seat tracks. I've done, you know,
you've done triplers because I know the airline that you work for. I'm just kidding.
You're good.
I'll cut it.
But, you know, I've done them and I can do them. It just takes me a little bit longer. I make just making sure everything's perfect and all that. But, you know, when you watch somebody fabricate some of these repairs, you're just like, this is awesome. They're so good at it. They make it seem so easy.
I'm definitely not the artist when it comes to that kind of stuff. I mean, I like music. I like, you know, maybe with producing videos, but like when I have to work on my car, if there's anything cosmetic, I'm not touching it. Like I'm not, I get so frustrated. I just don't have the hand eye coordination to make something look pretty. Like I'm a, you know, studs and drywall carpenter. I'm not the, you know, paint finishing touches guys. No.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of like you. I thrive on give me a big part and I would love to replace it. That's what I love doing. That's why I like doing landing gear, because I'm like, I'm going to take that big gear out and I'll put a new one in. It's going to be great.
Yeah. It's funny because we do a lot of movement of aircraft that have been cargo converted. And those cargo converted airplanes, they have to be, all the flight controls, everything have to be re-rigged.
Oh, yeah.
And there's always one guy at that shop who is like the master of all rigging.
Yes, 100%. I it's not me, but I know the guy. I can get you in contact with him.
It's funny, like there's definitely a learning curve on it too. So when the 737 classic conversion was getting done for years and years, like the first like maybe 2 or 3 years of it, we would get in and they had two different type of manual reversion, like elevator rods that they have. One's titanium, I think one was like aluminum alloy or something. Yeah. And there were different tolerances for each one. And it's kind of a mystery. Like some airplanes had the titanium, some airplanes had the aluminum, and there were different numbers for them. And they could never get it right for years and years. Like we would go out there and we'd do the manual reversion test. You turn off the hydraulics and instantly, you know, you're at like a 20 degree pitch up or like a 15 degree pitch down, and like the M&Ms are, you know, on the ceiling, you know. And then over time, it got better and better and better. And then it's been years since I've had a misrigged manual reversion.
Yeah, the NGs are just like absolutely perfect every time. I mean, you don't even notice it.
Yeah, I love the NG. It's a good airplane. Yeah. It's a great airplane. It's a real workhorse. I love that thing.
What do you think of the Max, Max?
I haven't worked on it enough to have a very strong opinion, because where I'm working is we do heavy checks, and our Maxes haven't been in service long enough to need them. So they started, they're just now kind of getting to that point where we're going to start seeing them start coming through.
Yeah.
I did do the return to service back in 2020 when they got recertified. And they were fun to work on. I think they look cool. I like the engine.
Yeah, it's a great flying airplane.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the cockpit's nice too.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a little bit more clean than the NG.
Yeah.
From a maintenance perspective, between the 737 MAX and the NG, I mean, from a pilot's perspective, there is very, very little different, and that's by design. How is that particular aircraft from classic to NG to MAX from a systems perspective? I mean, are there different like courses that you have to take for initials and recurrency, or is it cover everything?
We took a MAX differences class where you just kind of learn about the things that are a little bit different than the MAX. Okay. And a lot of it was avionics related. And then the engines, obviously different, totally different engines. Yeah. You got the composite fan blades and all that stuff.
So with that said, have you worked on any of the 787s?
I did. Yeah. I did a few light checks on the 787. It's a really clean airplane to work on. It's all electric. It's just not.
Yes.
You're not dealing with as much, like hardly any hydraulic fluid, anything like that.
Right.
It's really clean. You take off the panels, you're like, has this thing even flown? The packs are really interesting on it. They're real beefy packs on that thing.
The CACs, cabin air compressors. So yeah. Bob and I are rated on the 787. We both have very limited experience on it. I mean, I've flown couple handfuls of times. Bob, yeah, I think Bob's flown it a little more. I don't know. I have a couple hundred hours on it. I think Bob is the same. And we did our type ratings in Denver at the United facility.
Okay.
And we did them as differences courses off of the 777 and off of our 777 range.
Interesting.
Ratings. So in the U.S. anyway, the 787 and the 777 are simply CCQs. They're different. They're like differences courses. So we have to do a type ride on them, but it's not as extensive. So we did our 787 in three sims and a check ride, four total times in the simulator versus an initial, which is like 8 to 10, right? Based off of the triple. But while we were going through it, I said to myself, I don't understand how this is. There is nothing similar.
It's two different airplanes.
I find that totally. That's wild to me because for us, it was totally different trainings.
That was my ask because it's such a different airplane.
Yeah, I had my 777 Gen Fam and I had my 787 Gen Fam. They were completely separate. They're not really ratings on the AMP side, but qualifications. Right. That's bizarre to me. Because I agree, they're totally different.
Everything from the skin systems being composite versus aluminum, which is huge, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't even know how you do structural work on a carbon airplane, but, you know.
Layups. It's a different engines, too. Totally different.
Different engines. You have, you know, so there's almost no bleed air system whatsoever. There's only bleed air for the engine anti-ice, the engine nacelle.
Everything else
is electric. The brakes are electric.
Yep.
The engines start like a turboprop, starter generators.
Yep. It's a cool airplane, but that's interesting to me. And what's interesting about the 787, which isn't that exciting for most people, but the panels are all held on with Torx fasteners, Torx bits, you know, like the little star bits.
Yeah.
Really?
And every other airplane I've ever worked on is a Phillips head. So that's nice. They don't strip as easy.
Huh.
Yeah.
It's convenient from a mechanic standpoint, but
I wonder, it'll be interesting to see if Boeing continues in that direction. Like, so the MAX is still Phillips head?
Mm-hmm.
It is. Yep.
Everything's Phillips most of the time. Or they use what's called a quad wing, which is basically like an offset Phillips. And I hate those things also.
You guys have all your own tools. Is that still a standard?
Yeah. We supply our own like basic hand tools. Anything that's calibrated or specialties provided by the companies. So I don't even think we're allowed to have our own torque wrench because they have to get calibrated and, you know, be tracked, stuff like that.
Right.
But like basic hand tools is all supplied by ourselves.
Yeah, I guess that would be like if you apply you know, an engine mount to a spec different than what Boeing wants, there's a lot of liability there.
And if it's your own torque wrench, like when's the last time you had it calibrated? It's like never. You know, like the torque wrench I have in my house, like I've never calibrated it. I don't know. I just trust it. But I'm also not working on airplanes with it. So
yeah. Right. So I see mechanics at the heavy MRO places, you know, going to a window and checking out tools.
Yeah.
What are they doing there?
Well, that's where you get like the specialty stuff, you know? So like if you needed to check the pedostatic system, that's where you're going to get the kit
test
for
box.
That. Yeah. The test box and all that stuff, or, you know, torque wrenches or consumables. You're going to get your grease or whatever you need, your hydraulic fluid. Typically you check that out. And they check it out to your employee number where I work so that, you know, they make sure you get it back, which half the time I'm like, why would anybody want to steal this? Like, This is the most worthless tool unless you're like changing a main landing gear on a 737. Then it's really handy, but I can't imagine using this for anything else.
Probably because of how much it costs. I know
100%. 100%.
So I was on a 737 trip two weeks ago, and they were doing a pedostatic check, which I've witnessed a bunch of times. And you know, the box, it comes in like this, you know, it's like a little plastic box. It's not really that big.
Looks like a Pelican.
Yeah. There's a bunch of hose, and you know, you plug like a static and you plug the pedo tube and whatever. I found out that those things range from about like $250,000 on the low end to like $800,000 on the high end.
Yeah.
So, holy cow.
I don't think that the airlines are paying these guys enough to own their own pedostatic test kit.
Definitely not.
Because you want to live in it.
Yeah, I mortgaged a pedostatic test kit.
Feed your kids with the pedostatic test kit. Yeah. You know.
Man. Sorry, boys, we can't go on vacation this year. Dad bought a pedostatic system. Yeah.
So, in that same light, kind of there's a process there, obviously. And, you know, is there also a process of like who do you report to? Like when you're doing these heavy maintenance checks, who are you reporting to and who's giving you the tasks and things to do?
I want to back it up 1 second before you get to that, because this is part of a larger thing that I wanted to cover, because I know a lot of people, they hear C check, they hear D check, you know, they hear even me. I mean, even like I deal with this stuff all the time, and I know that there are different maintenance programs. There's the MSG3 maintenance program. There's different phase checks. I mean, there's A2 and A3 and B1. Can you talk about heavy checks a little bit, like dumb it down as much as you can, like not for the audience, like for us?
Okay. Yeah. So there's different phases of different types of checks, right? So there's several different types of A checks. And so one A check might have you checking, aileron flight control systems. And then another one might have you checking something else on the aircraft. In the C check side of thing, and they're typically time controlled, right? So when an aircraft hits, say, 70,000 flight hours, you have to perform this level of C check. This is what you're going to do. You can't go past it. You can't. So we'll get the aircraft in on a certain type of C check. And it'll be scheduled to have like a landing gear change. It'll be scheduled to have, you know, these certain inspections done. Like there's a certain inspection on the 737 where it gets a certain amount of flight hours, and you have to basically HVEC check the entire crown skin down the entire fuselage. And that has to be done at whatever 70,000 flight hours or whatever the number is. I can't remember off the top of my head.
That's not the lap joint inspection, is it?
I don't think so.
I'm not sure if they have that anymore with the NGs. I don't know, though.
Yeah.
Where I work, we just did our first one like a month ago, and it wasn't even on my dock. But so it just kind of, it's a time-based thing. So when an airframe hits this many hours or this many cycles, there's this big package basically that's like you have to do all of these things, inspect all of these things. You're checking for corrosion, you're checking for, you know, abnormal wear. And then while it's also there, you're getting rid of all of those MELs or those, you know, NEF items that aren't necessarily time controlled, right? So like you'll be like, okay, we're going to put a new aft flap on because this one's got, you know, some small dents on it. We're just going to send that to the shop. And by the time it leaves, hopefully it's as good as new.
Those are considered non-routines? Is that
so? Yeah, there's non-routines, and then there's, you know, scheduled tasks, right? So a scheduled task would be something like we're going to replace the swivel fittings on the leading edge slats. Those are routine. We're going to do it on every aircraft. Or like a scheduled thing is going to be doing a carbon brake mod where we replace the steel brakes with carbon brakes, and you replace some hydraulic lines and add some flow limiters to them.
That would be like a fleet-wide upgrade or something that comes off of an AD or something like that.
And so what happens is at the beginning of one of these checks, we open up all of these external panels. We open up the aircraft for a couple of days. It takes a few days to get this whole thing opened up. And then there's a whole team of inspectors that come out, and they walk around with their flashlights, and they have certain areas that they're inspecting, and they'll write every little thing up you know, corrosion at this nut plate, corrosion on this hydraulic clamp. And then we'll go to work to our, we report to a crew chief. This is all going to loop in together. We report to a crew chief. They sign out job assignments to each one of us. They'll be like, hey, I need you to do this routine where you're changing the hydraulic fittings, or hey, I need you to go look at this hydraulic clamp that the inspector wrote up. And then you'll go out there, you verify the discrepancy, you'll take off the hydraulic clamp, probably need to order a new one, and then, you know, you'll replace it. And that way you're addressing all of these things that the inspection finds. Some things, when you're done with the job, you need an inspector to come buy it back. Some things are not inspection items.
Now, who are the inspectors? Are the inspectors, were they at one time, you know, regular mechanics?
Yep.
It's an IA rating, right?
No, IA is, that's just for general aviation typically.
Oh, okay.
So you actually don't need your IA in the commercial side of things, but you do go through additional training. And they're typically where I'm at, you know, they've been there for a long time. They're really smart. They've seen a lot. They've seen everything kind of thing.
They're experienced guys.
Yeah. And so they'll come out, you know, if you're doing like mounting major hardware, they have to look at the torque wrench, verify that you have it set to the right level, check that it's calibrated, watch you torque it, watch you safety it.
Wow.
And they'll say, yep, he did it right. And then you go on to the next thing.
I knew there was oversight, but I didn't realize there was that intense of oversight.
Yeah, and it depends on what you're doing. If it's a, you know, flight control, basically if it's anything to do with the flight control, it's probably going to be an inspection item. If I'm just replacing a hydraulic clamp, you don't need an inspector for that kind of thing. I'm signing it off with my license.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so when an airplane comes in, and let's say it's coming in for a, I don't know, C-1 or whatever, are you assigned to that particular airplane until it's released?
Typically, yeah. Typically,
so you're not hopping around to different aircraft doing different items.
No, you can, and you can't. That's kind of individual.
Depends on what needs to be done, right?
If you're the guy that knows how to rig the spoilers, then you're going to be calling to rig spoilers on something else.
So where I work, the hangar is separated by docks, and the docks are part of a shop. And so my shop has two docks for two 737s. And typically you're going to be assigned to a crew, and that crew is assigned to one dock that's responsible for one aircraft. And then, you know, but like you said, if you need help, you know, you can go to the guy over on the dock next to you on a dock and be like, hey man, can you come give me a hand with this, or, you know, help me understand what I'm reading or looking at here.
Right.
But yeah, typically you're assigned to one dock. You work one airplane. That's your plane. That's your baby until it leaves. And it takes anywhere between 30 and 40 days for us to get through one check.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think people realize how maintenance intensive these airplanes that they're, you know, riding around on.
Yeah.
You know, what they actually go through. I mean, how often?
I hope it makes them
often?
Feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. It should.
If you've ever seen an airplane that's in the middle of a check, you'll think to yourself, and even I think this as someone who is around these all the time, that thing's never going to fly again.
It does look like that, doesn't it?
I know. How are they ever going to get it put back together?
They get torn up, but it goes back together. We know where everything goes. We know where everything's supposed to be. And by the end of it, thankfully, looks a lot better than when it came in, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when they come in, I'm like, look at this dirty airplane, dude. This thing is a piece of junk. And then when it leaves, it's like, it looks pretty nice.
You know? Yeah. And walking through the hangars, I've always seen, like, when a part comes off, they're pretty organized as to where it sits when it's off the airplane. So like a certain shelf labeled, you know, all the gear components are together, all the wing components are together and labeled with a tail number and MSN, every piece of masking tape on it with, you know, with something written or probably printed.
Where it was removed from. Yeah, that kind of thing. And, you know, what's nice about working on it in aviation as opposed to people that might work in cars or commercial aviation is that you have access to really good manuals. Well, some of my mechanic friends are like, these manuals aren't good. I'm like, okay, that's fair. But the information's in there. Whether you can find it or not, somebody can, but it's in there and you'll find the exact part number, the exact this, and you're going to get it. And if you don't have the right part, you can't just, you're not just like, oh, we'll just throw this one on there. You're like, no, we're going to wait until we get the right part, you know?
Right. Yeah, we've had some experience dealing with MBF, My Boeing Fleet, they call it. It's like it's like a software, like a central repository of all things Boeing for that particular aircraft, part numbers, locations, test procedures, button press sequences, everything.
Yeah, it so goes, they're very in-depth. And so that's one of the things that I like about it personally is I like, when I work on my car or like work on my house, I'm like, there's no, where's the manual? They're like, it's
with, right.
Chat GPT, baby.
YouTube.
I even ask it maintenance questions all the time. Chat. It knows quite a bit. I mean, at least it thinks it knows quite a bit.
It thinks it knows. It might not.
How often do you have to go to the manufacturer because you guys have found something that's completely stumped you?
Systems wise, not that often, but we do have our own team of engineers that can do certain things. Typically what I see is on a Boeing is when we're doing like a structural repair or something like that. Like let's say it got hit by a bag loader and then it gets ferried to us because we're like the heavy hitters of heavy maintenance for them. So if it gets hit by a belt loader, depending on the severity of the repair or the damage, it might have to go to Boeing. Our engineering team will send it to Boeing to say, this is the repair we're going to do. And then Boeing's engineering will review it. And then they'll kind of bless it and send it back to us. Typically, we'll see it with that. And then I've seen the Boeing team has had to come out a few times to do it themselves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen the Boeing Go team before, but they're pretty impressive.
We've been involved in a couple AOG situations where they've came out or the Airbus team has come out.
Yeah.
We moved an airplane that had an RPG hole through the fuselage once.
What kind of airplane?
737.
Really?
Yeah.
Where was it? Where was the hole?
It was like between two frame bays, like mid fuselage, and the warhead didn't detonate. So it went through one side and out the other, and it made two clean holes. And Boeing determined that the aircraft was safe to fly unpressurized, and we flew it from the UAE to the US.
From Karachi, Pakistan.
Oh, that's right. It was from Pakistan.
It didn't hit a frame. It just went through
everything.
That was really thoughtful of whoever fired it.
Yeah. it's like one of those things where you get shot in like in the chest and it like misses everything. Like,
and
it
just
was
goes
one of those
clean out. Yeah, that's wild. That's crazy. Yeah. See, 737 is a good airplane.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, when in doubt, what I found with Boeing is they're pretty, you know, as long as a frame bay is not involved, to say, go ahead and fly it as long as you don't pressurize it. And the thing is, because the pressurization is what changes everything, even if there's damage that you can't see, once you put the thing under pressure, that's when problems are going to happen, right?
So right.
It's very predictable when it's...
So you have to stay under flight level, whatever it might be.
10,000.
That's low.
10,000. And it's thirsty at 10,000, man.
It's a long
flight. From 10,000. You flew from 10,000 feet all the way from the UAE or Pakistan to the
US. I think it was 16 stops. It was crazy.
Yeah. That's wild.
I think
that's
that went, wild. Did that go to Goodyear, Arizona, or was that Roswell? I can't remember.
One of the two. I don't remember either. What about weird... Or like, whoa, I've never seen that before. What's the weirdest thing you've ever seen as a mechanic?
When I was working the line, we had an aircraft return to gate and they call us. They're like, hey, I can't remember the nose number or the tail number, but they're like, it's returning to gate. And we were like, oh, okay, why? And they're like, oh, there's a bat. There's a bat flying around. And so what happened was it was the middle of summer. And we left the doors open, the forward door and the aft door open, so we could get some airflow going through the cabin because it was just so hot while we were working. We finished the night and we closed the doors. And I'm guessing a bat decided, hey, that looks like a cool place, cool little cave. And it flew in there. And then it must have like hid under somebody's seat or something. I don't know. And they went to taxi out and the bat did not like the turboprops. And it starts flying up and down the cabin.
Man.
There was a video of it. and it returns the gate. And the pilot was like, oh, this is a bat. And we're like, what do you want? What do you want me to do about it? Like,
I call him exterminator.
Yeah, I'm just as qualified on bat removal as you, dude. This doesn't seem like a mechanic issue. And they did actually. They took it. They deboarded the flight, moved everybody to a different one, and then they had us shut the doors and put tape over them so nobody would open the doors until an exterminator could come get rid of the bat.
Oh, they killed the
bat.
They
didn't just shoot it out.
I don't know if they killed it. No, because they couldn't verify that it was gone. I don't know. They wanted to verify the bat was out of the aircraft before they put passengers on it.
Oh,
that one was
God.
Pretty funny.
I had a bird down in Sao Carlos, Brazil. We were taking a 320 out on one of those LATAM deals, and we were taxiing out. And in Sao Carlos, it's a heavy maintenance facility for LATAM. It's a very small airport. There's nobody around. And they'll just leave the airplane sitting on the ramp for hours with all the doors open because it's so hot there.
Yeah, they get hot.
Yeah. So, I mean, every single one of the doors was open and somehow a bird got in and we're taxiing out and it was brrr, brrr, brrr. So we just stopped with both engines running and we opened up. I opened up the main door and I was just like running through with papers going like that. And I chased the thing and I have video of it. I got to find it on my phone. Oh,
God.
That's awesome.
All I get is insects. I get cockroaches and centipedes.
Yeah, we don't like those.
Yeah, you were with me on one of those, Steve, with the MD-80 out of Africa, out of Congo.
It had been sitting for a long time. There were roaches. Once we got up to altitude, the roaches started dropping out of the overhead panel and scurrying around on the center pedestal. I still remember.
Yeah.
They 5 ate November, our, Bravo, India.
Yeah, that was out of Nigeria. That's right. And it ate our catering. They ate our catering.
I know.
So pissed off.
That's the worst part of the whole story.
Exactly.
We're starving. Yeah, I don't know that I would have eaten that catering anyway.
I did. I worked on an aircraft once that went off the runway, got ferried back from somewhere in the Caribbean, and we were working on it. And I was working in the Kruger flaps, and there was like dirt up in the Kruger flaps, which I just, out of all the things I've ever found in a Kruger flap, it's the only time I've ever seen dirt up there. You know what I mean?
It's the leading edge of the wing for people that don't know on a Kruger.
Yes.
Like, sorry. It's not like coming up from the tires.
No, I don't know how they got there.
On the wing.
Yeah, there's like grass stuck to the accumulator. It was funny. I was like, never seen that.
I'm genuinely curious about this. We've heard about pilot shortages. Clearly, everyone that I talk to in the MRO business, it's hard. There is not a lot of new blood coming in.
Nope.
Is that your experience?
Yep. Yeah.
How bad is it?
Well, luckily where I'm at, they pay us really well. So we're not having that much of an issue finding people. But I know in general, there's going to be a mechanic shortage, a big one, you know, and a lot of these dudes are getting to the age of retirement. You know, they're getting ready to retire. And not only we're not going to have the manpower, but then you're losing all that knowledge as well, you know, because these guys have been doing it a long time. And they know more about, we all say they've forgotten more about fixing airplanes than I've ever known. You
know? Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely a shortage of it. And I've actually talked to people that, just because of my social media, have been inspired to become aircraft mechanics, because like me, they were like, I'd never even thought of that I didn't know that existed as a job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not the kind of job that's going to be replaced. Yeah. It's not the kind of job that AI is going to take. You need to be a human being.
No.
Yeah.
They don't even have robots building airplanes yet, you know?
Right.
Let alone, I saw like cars where it's like an automated assembly line. These are handmade machines, really, you know, for the most part.
And there's a lot, there's so many variables. I mean, obviously there's going to be AI pathways for troubleshooting, you know?
Sure.
I mean, I know that there's already certain like augmented reality
visual
things. Yeah, yeah, like where mechanics can, you know, put on like a headset and look something, things will be identified. And, you know, I mean, obviously there are tools that will utilize this automation, but at the end of the day, you need a person making decisions. There's a decision making process. There are judgment calls. I mean, some things are black and white, but there's definitely tons of judgment calls, I would think, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, no, I think it's a very safe career to get into in terms of like not losing it to automation or anything like that. Cause planes, as long as planes are flying, they're going to need somebody to fix them. They break a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In small ways, but.
And a lot of inspections. I mean, it's
mostly inspections,
constant inspections.
And it's kind of like when people are talking about, not to loop back to C-checks, but when people are like, I'll see people on the internet and be like, why is this aircraft from 1995 still flying? And you're like, well, because it can and it's fine.
Right. Little of it is still from 1995.
Right. Like, imagine if every 6 years you took your car to the shop and they put on new paneling, a new engine, new transmission, new drivetrain, overhauled the entire thing. You'd never need a new car, right?
Right.
Because you're just constantly overhauling it, basically.
Case in point, Cape Air, you know, a place that I worked, you know, 26, 7, 6 years ago or so.
A long time ago
in my career. They're still operating some of the same Cessna 402s that have 60, 70, 80,000 cycles on them.
Yeah.
But how much of that airplane is still the original? I'd argue almost none. And in fact, Cessna goes to Cape Air when they have a question about supporting something that's on the Cessna 402 fleet. They fabricate, like, they'll do like these production runs where they'll fabricate their own intake manifolds, exhaust manifolds, exhaust pipes. They'll go to a factory and they'll produce 50 of them because it's cheaper to do 50 at once than to do one whenever you need it.
Right.
And then they have them in stores. Now, these parts are, you know, you can't like sell them elsewhere. They're only approved for use in Cape Air aircraft by their maintenance program and everything else. But they do skins, wing skins, fuselage skins. Every piece of that airplane is replaced.
Wow. Yeah, we have a manufacturing shop where I'm at. And so we can, you know, we can take a component off and be like, it goes to manufacturing and they can CNC and mill it and get us a new one that we then install on the aircraft.
Man. Oh, wow. You know,
and
so it doesn't have to be a part that's like ordered from Boeing and like shipped to you, kind of a
some are and some aren't, you know. And I think it just depends on, it's all approved within our maintenance program and however they've figured that out. That's something above my pay grade. I just install the stuff and take it off. But
back to like the impending mechanic shortage.
Yeah.
And this is something that Bob and I are quite passionate about, is getting new blood in. And just like you, we have people obviously always reaching out. Hey, I want to become a pilot. What's the path? I'm 40. Is it too late? You know, the answer is pretty much no all the time, unless you're 60. And
hey, I'm just starting.
And the reality is there's not a lot of people know about it. I don't, you know, we live in the time. And I think that there's going to be a paradigm shift in this coming up. There has to be with this AI revolution. For the last 25, 30 years, parents, at least in the United States, have kind of worked with your head, not with your hands.
Right.
I remember my grandfather specifically told me that. Like, my grandfather worked with his hands. And when we were younger, he said, work with your head, not with your hands, because your hands will give out and your brain will not. But the reality is a lot of the brain jobs are being modernized into non-human roles. Working with your hands is not only a job that's here to stay, but it's also a job that is increasingly paying more.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially as there is a lack of interested people in the pipeline that are going in there. I would argue pretty much anyone can be a pilot. Pretty much anybody can be an engineer or a mechanic. Key is you have to find a place to get the training, and I think that there's just not that many of them, and I think that there's not enough, right?
Certainly not marketed. It's certainly not marketed well.
It's definitely not. And you know, with on the A&P side of things, there's if you're like me, I never served in the military, so there is like a fast track way to get an A&P if you have the relevant experience. But there's A&P schools, and there's some A&P programs that are just offered by community colleges. And you can get your license for maybe, I don't know about anymore, but less than $10,000, you get your A&P license. Maybe,
wow,
definitely less than 20 from a community college.
Yeah.
And then the private colleges, I think they're running about 50,000, which when you tell an old head, you know, 50 grand for an A&P license, they're like, what? I got mine for 400. And I'm like, well,
times have changed.
But you know,
what is entry level like salary like in the field?
Where I'm at, I'd have to look at the contract, but I think where I'm at, I think they're starting at like 38, 39 bucks an hour. Not bad. You know, it's pretty good. I was making $18 an hour when I started, but I think it's basically doubled from that. You know, definitely, I wouldn't do what I do for less than 25 an hour. No shot. But I think entry level, I'd have to look around. I don't know what it is anymore, but where I'm at, it's close to 40, if not over 40 an hour, which is, you know, pretty good.
Yeah. Especially when you tie in the benefits and
once you hit 5-6 years in the industry, your pay is going to go up quite a bit.
I want to just sum up that whole discussion about the new blood and say, you know, stay tuned to this space through us. I mean, I think that there are vast resources that need to be tapped when you start getting into like inner city schools from the maintenance and the operation side and the dispatch side and the planning side. I mean, I want to see, my son goes to school in the city of Philadelphia, and the school that he's in is a private school, but they outreached, you know, to some of the other inner city schools. And these kids are just not seeing opportunities. Aviation is one of these places where there's so much demand
for
skilled labor going forward, whether that be flying in the airplanes or fixing the airplanes or planning the flights, that I want to make it kind of my personal legacy to this business to really kind of open that pipeline. And so I don't really know exactly where we're going with it yet, but I know it's something that Bob and I are passionate about. Sounds like you're passionate about it. Well, we're going to put together kind of a team at some point to really kind of explore what we can do to kind of
inspire the
next generation.
Well, and you know, like it's you're going to get a good, as a mechanic, it's a good paying job. And I can't really see myself doing anything else for a living unless I was playing music or getting paid to play video games professionally, which I'm not that good at them. But other than that, I'm like, I've thought about it over the years. I'm like, no, I'm pretty happy I did this. Like I can't picture myself doing anything else. I really can't.
This is a nice segue actually into what I wanted to get to next, you know, is, I mean, you're a single dad.
Yeah.
And I've learned quite a bit about your story over the last few weeks and having kind of anticipating this interview. Tragically, you lost your wife a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I want to get into that a little bit.
Sure.
You know, kind of in a roundabout way. But I mean, this is a career that you are able to do as a single dad raising two young kids. I mean, that is the most impressive thing. I already said to Bob, and when we were briefing this, I said, God forbid, if something like this happened to us, our kids would be eating out of dumpsters.
Yeah.
Like, without a doubt.
I mean, it hasn't been easy. The schedule for A&P mechanics can be rough, but you're home every day. I'm able to, you know, provide for my kids, keep a roof over their head. You know, I'm able to see them every day and take care of them. And it's been rough, but luckily, my job does provide enough flexibility if you need it, that you can make these kind of things happen. You know what I mean? So if I need Saturday off, I can give it away to a guy I work with. He'll work on Saturday. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if I need to pick up a Tuesday, I can pick up a Tuesday and stuff like that. And so it has provided me enough to be able to still provide for my kids, you know.
You're not on the PTA, but your kids are making their soccer games.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely not on the PTA. But you know, and you know, I get to fly them around if they, you know, if they want to go somewhere, we can just we can go.
That's right. You got the flight benefits.
You got the flight benefits. And, you know, it's, I don't know, it's treated me well, I think, the career has.
Yeah.
It's unimaginable to me what you've gone through and, you know, the fact that, I mean, you're inspiring so many people. I think most of us would crawl into a hole and maybe you did originally. I don't even know how, you know, life is, look, if you haven't experienced tragedy in your life, you know, knock on wood and thank God, but you're going to, right. I mean, everybody's going to at some point.
Yeah.
What has been the key to your success in rebounding from just something that's just unimaginably tragic?
Well, for me, it was my kids, right? Without them, I would have, I don't know. I probably would have stopped going into work. I don't know. They kept me.
You have to, right?
You have to. Yeah. I just kept going for them. And you know, where I work, when I first started going back to work, I was like, I'm not going to do much today. And the guys on my crew were like, you're good. We'll take care of it. You know what I mean?
They're like, yeah. Just
help out right. When you need to. And that was nice. I was really supported by the guys I work with and a lot of my friends out there. And then when I first started making the videos was when I was at arguably one of the worst points for me, the lowest. And that became a distraction, right? It became a way to, which a bad word in aviation, but good distraction for me at that point. I mean,
yeah.
No, absolutely.
And you know, I was rereading this. I was rereading Lord of the Rings at the time, and just being able to talk about two things that I love, you know, and then seeing people that enjoyed that I was doing that and providing laughter. At first, I just thought it was making people laugh, and then I realized I was actually teaching people, about two things. You know, I'm teaching people about airplanes. I'm teaching people about Lord of the Rings, and it kind of just kept me going. Plus, my kids. And just being like, and then it kind of gave me an idea of what a future could be, that a future still exists, you know, that there is, it will get better in some way.
Whatever that vibe was when you first started putting the videos out, I mean, my wife was drawn to it like immediately. I mean, she's been watching your stuff from the very beginning, and she's like, you gotta watch this guy, you gotta see what he's putting out there, you know. Is it that vulnerability, but that you know, you're very, you know, you seem like a very honest human being, like a real, like the real deal, and I think that comes across in your social media posts very, very strong.
Agreed.
I try to be you know, I don't know, I don't know. Life's hard, so if you can provide some levity to people, I think that's...
Yes.
Agreed.
I don't know. That's what I like the most about it. And it helped me too, you know? Maybe the best way to help others, or the best way to help yourself sometimes can be to help others, or to just to try to kind of provide some good.
Absolutely. I mean,
what about the music? Like, I mean, you make... So first of all, if you don't know that Max is a musician. I mean, you can tell by it, you know, the way he looks. I mean, I hate to be that guy, but I mean,
he's the rock star.
It's fine.
I mean, I'm trying, man. I just don't have the volume you got, you know. I mean, I'm getting there, but
yeah.
Look, your music is, and I'm not just saying this. I truly dig your music, and
thanks.
I didn't even know you were a musician, but I started listening to your stuff, and. Man, it's really, really good. And I'm not blowing smoke. We're going to, if you agree to it, we're going to close out the episode with one of your tracks to give people, you good with that?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
I noticed that, you know, your songs are all very, personal with regard mostly to your journey of losing your wife and dealing with grief and so forth. And I think it's very powerful, and the tunes are good too. You know,
thank you.
It's folky rock, acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
You got a good voice. Thanks. And I love it, man. I just want to say I love your music. And
thank you.
I think you got a future in that, to be honest.
Maybe.
And I like that Martin.
it's a nice Martin. Martin makes a good guitar. But yeah, I with my music, that's just kind of just a hobby of love for me, you know?
Artistic release.
Yeah. And it's just something that I like doing. And I really just kind of wrote the songs for myself. And then my friends were the ones that were like, these are pretty good, man. You should record and put them out there. And I was like, okay. But then I don't like doing self promo. So I'm just like, I'll put it out there. If somebody wants to listen to it, they can. I'll post about it sometimes. But a lot of people are like, I didn't know you played. I'm like, yeah. A little bit.
Well, I want to put it out there because I think it needs to be heard. I think it's good. I legit think it's very, very good.
Thanks.
And to the point where it's part of my rotation and it comes on when I play, you know, when I'm driving. So yeah. I dig it, man.
Yeah, that's my first passion in life, I would say, was always music. But you know, it's fun to do. I've never really played a show yet. Maybe.
I think you should.
We'll see.
Wandering Heart is my favorite, by the way.
That's
for the record.
I was really happy with how that one turned out. But yeah, I just like writing music. You know, it's a hobby of mine. I should do it more often. I got so many songs that I've written that I've just never recorded. You know, I think I've only got five on Spotify. But man, I got a repertoire of like 20 and 30 I could probably do.
You're a young guy, not like Bob.
Hey,
plenty of time.
Why's Bob catching strays, dude?
Seriously.
He didn't say anything.
He's the one with your gray hair over here.
I always have to give Bob some, you know, some of it about his
age,
but you know.
Fair enough.
I seem to keep catching him, so.
Catching up fast, buddy.
Catching up fast.
I'm catching up as fast as I can, but time only moves as fast as it does.
For sure. Well, I'm genuinely curious to know how you got into the Lord of the Rings, the whole J.R.R. Tolkien thing.
Again, one of my first loves in life. Now, my dad took me to the movies when they first came out, and I freaked out. I was like, these are so good. I read the books all the time. I reread it constantly. I fell in love with it. And when I first started making my videos, I wasn't making them based on Lord of the Rings. They were just little one-liners about airplanes, really, really kind of dry humor. And then one day I was like, I was rereading the books and I thought, well, I wonder if I could make one of my videos about Lord of the Rings. And I did. It was about a fan blade being different than Andoril, which is the sword Aragorn carries. It's from the shards of Narsil that's reforged. Narsil was forged by Telkar in the First Age, right? And so I was like, okay, well, I could do that. I could just tell the story of Andoril compared to an airplane fan blade. And so I made that video, and it went kind of viral, little viral. And then people were like, this is what I want to see. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know if I could do that again, right? How would I? And then I saw the escape raft on a set 777. I was working in the cabin. I saw the escape raft and I was like, well, they take rafts from Lothlorien when they leave Kedas Galadhon to sail down the Anduin. And the fellowship breaks at the Parth Galen where Boromir's slain and Frodo sails across Lake Ninhithuel. And then he goes through the Imid Mule where they tame Sméagol before leading him across the Dead Waste. And I was like, okay, well, I could just say that. You know what I mean?
I can't wait to edit this episode. Oh my God. I can't wait to see how this stuff is. Sorry, Bob. I'm jumping on you here.
We're both so excited. I know.
Well, I can't wait to see how it spells the things that you just said.
Yeah, don't worry about the spelling. They'll figure it out.
Well, I don't think that I'm uploading a transcript anyway, so it doesn't matter, but it's just a general curiosity.
One time I uploaded the captions and it auto-corrected Frodo to Fardo and I changed it, but I was like, man, I should have just kept that. That's funny.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, yeah, that's how
Bob
I
doesn't
got...
change the captions either when he does one of his TikToks.
I never
There do. Was one recently that was hilarious and sexually oriented.
I got it. He's a busy man. He doesn't have time to edit TikTok.
Yeah, I don't edit TikTok stuff. I just put it out there.
Yeah, that's what I like to do too.
Max, this has been awesome, man. I mean, this is by far the best content we've done so far. And let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, dude, I'm always down.
Let's just, anything you want to promote?
No.
Nothing. No. How about promoting the youth getting involved in
Oh, well, that, like, in general, yeah, they should come be an aircraft mechanic with me. It's fun. It's really cool. You can get the training done, which is, you know, what I think for me, I didn't want to go to, like, I needed a career, right? I needed something I could do and to you know, support my family. And I was like, I don't want to go to school for 4 years. I don't have time to get a bachelor's. I got a 1-year-old right now. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I didn't like the idea of like working in an office or working behind a desk or anything like that. I wanted to be out and walking around and doing stuff. You know what I mean? And you can get your A&P. It took me a year and a half, you know, it was a year and a half, 18 months. And I had my license. I think some schools do it within a year now or something like that. There's faster programs even now than when I did it.
And it's kind of a license to learn. I mean, you get out there on the line and you learn on the job.
And there's people always need A&P mechanics. There's a shortage of mechanics, not a shortage of jobs. You know what I mean? I will say one caveat is sometimes in this industry, you might need to relocate. You know, I moved across the country 3 times but I didn't mind it. I was like, I'm going to do it. But there's also that a lot of people don't think of with A&P mechanics is there's just like pilots that a lot of people don't think of. When you think about a pilot, people think, oh, they're going to go work for the airlines, but that's not necessarily the case, right? It's a massive industry with a lot of different things. I have a friend that's an A&P mechanic that works on firebombing helicopters in Oregon. You know, he's out in the middle of Oregon working on rotary, and he just likes hiking and stuff like that. And then he fixes helicopters.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. You can be a flight mechanic. I don't know if you guys ever work with them, but I have some friends that are flight mechanics. You know, they're flying all around the world and that's their plane, and they just have their toolbox with them and they take care of what needs to take care of while they're wherever they might be.
Yeah.
And the on-site reps is a big one. And that's that, you know, in 15, 20 years when your kids are, you know, out living their lives as adults and you know, you feel like you may want to do some traveling.
Yeah.
Call us up. Well, I mean, Bob will be dead, but
famous last words of Steve.
Damn. I live to regret that. No, you know, the on-site reps, most of them are like 55 to like 70, and they go and stay with an airplane in Hong Kong for a month, and then they go to Dubai for a month, and then they go wherever. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff you can do.
It's a crazy industry, and there's so many niches in it and so many things, and you could see the world. Even if you just want to work for the airlines, you can still see the world because you're going to be able to fly for free. It just depends. Like, once you get your license, you have a license to learn, and the world's your oyster, and it never expires either. It's a lifetime rating for us. There's no renewal or anything like that. Right. Yeah, see, my Siri doesn't understand that, but I'm telling you, it's true.
Oh, man. Well, let's listen. He's too humble to say it, but Airplane Facts with Max is the account on Instagram and
you got TikTok too.
TikTok.
I stream on Twitch. There, we can promote that. I stream.
Okay.
If anybody likes video game streams, I stream video games on Twitch sometimes, mostly World of Warcraft.
And check out
my music, I guess.
And check out his music. Links will be in the show notes, and you will hear some of that starting now. Thanks, Max.
No, appreciate that was it, Max. Fun, guys.
Yeah. It was a blast. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm happy to yap anytime, man, about whatever. You guys just want to do it again.
Definitely want to do it again.
Yeah.
I wish I could hold you like I used to. Wish I could hold you like all those years ago. 'Cause being alive don't feel like living when you're living.
So I'll just wait like the dog sitting at your door. And tonight I'll drink till I can't drive. Do my best to just survive. Cause these seasons are changing, Lord, I ain't doing alright. You said that we both need a reason. Honey, my reason was you. And now I don't know what the fuck I'm gonna do without you. Best to just survive, cause these seasons.